Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey there, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Aces.
Glad to hear it.
Doing well. I want to bring up the first topic of the day, if you don't mind.
I don't mind.
Clicking around like I have want to do late at night.
Tell your wife you're doing work. You're on YouTube. Looking up booty dancing.
A few nights ago, I'm watching, it must be on Sunday nights, Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah.
Must be either Sundays or Mondays because those are my typical days off. And I'm clicking around and the show is on and I really can't stand to watch it more than 5 or 10 minutes at a time, because it actually bothers me. It actually makes me feel angst.
Hell's Kitchen is a TV reality show starring celebrity chef Gordon Ramsay, who's a screaming maniac who berates people, and we're against it. And Top Chef is the show we're for.
And we get a lot of emails from you guys talking about Hell's Kitchen or Top Chef, and it seems like most of the emails we get, people are on our side as far as
Top Chef, good guy, Colicchio, good guy, Gordon Ramsay, screaming maniac.
Every once in a while, one of you will disagree and say, no, I love it. I love when he screams and berates them, but whatever. Anyway, so he gets done screaming, berating this woman who is in the kitchen and is basically a short order cook. She's never cooked in a fine dining restaurant. But she's one of the three finalists on the show, one of the last three people on the show, or last four people on the show. And you're watching the show, and you know that this woman cannot win. She does not have the background, okay? It's not like she's not smart enough.
Is she going up against a sous chef of some
type? Yeah, she's going up against real professional cooks. I mean, not that they're the greatest cooks in the world, frankly,
but they've worked in the great kitchens of the world, and she's worked in the diner.
Cooks, okay, they're real cooks, and she's a short order cook. She does not have the background to. And remember that the prize is to go cook in some professional, to be the chef of some professional restaurant. There's no way that Gordon Ramsay is going to allow her to win and be the chef of some professional restaurant. So now you know that Ramsay's been hearing about all the bad press that he's been getting about all the bashing he's been doing. I hear his BBC show, which is on the Travel Channel, and sooner or later I'll watch it when I'm done being nauseated by him, that he's much nicer on that show. So he gets this little moment of kindness, okay? Now, they flash back. I didn't watch the whole show, but they flash back to him calling her a stupid donkey and cursing at her and screaming at her and making her cry. And he turns to her and he says in this, and as he says, you know, hang up your coat and go, or whatever he says, but you know what? You've got some real ability. I'm going to send you to culinary school. We're going to pay for your culinary school.
Hey, that was pretty cool.
And I thought, wow, you must really be taking a lot of heat about being so mean.
Reading your own bad press.
You're going to send this girl. And frankly, If reality shows were more about that kind of stuff and were more about trying to bring people up and elevate people and make them do better with their lives, I would feel a lot better about the show.
So,
but I believe that this is a reaction to, wow, I'm getting a lot of negative publicity because I'm being such a jerk on the show that I better do something to show that I'm not a total jerk.
Well, there's also been a lot of press that out recently how of all the reality shows, that show, Hell's Kitchen, has never really come across with the prize, quote-unquote, that they say they're going to come across with. If you remember the first show, the prize was, what was it? It was either to have your own restaurant or be executive chef of your own restaurant, or go cook with Gordon Ramsay.
Oh,
right.
Those were the two choices. I remember that.
And there was a monetary award as well. And the guy supposedly turned down the monetary award, and what he won was a job. But it was a job.
With Gordon
Ramsay. And then the next one, the prize was to be an executive chef in a top restaurant in New York. And was that the Todd English one, or was that a different show?
I think that's a different show.
That's a different show. But they're not coming across with the prizes as they say. And
well,
I think that's a real prizes,
you know, if the prize is $100,000 and a bunch of kitchen equipment and a layout in Food and Wine magazine, like the prizes of Top Chef, well, either you got them or you didn't. It's easy.
Right. Well, but there are some complicated issues. The Bravo network runs Top Chef, which mm-hmm. is a show that we actually like quite a bit. And Harold Dieterle is the guy who won the first Top Chef. Mm-hmm. He took his $100,000 kitchen equipment.
He was on our show the day after he won, by
That's
the way.
That's right. And he took his kitchen equipment and his prize money and his fame and his layout. And he opened his own restaurant in the New York Times, recently got one star from mm-hmm. Frank Bruni in the New York Times, which is a pretty good opening gambit.
What I'm hearing from the people I know who've spent some time there, that is it. But though it's kind of like a chef's place, it's not fussy, it's not in your face, it's not showy, it's not flowery. It's the kind of place that you would go and have a good meal if you were a chef.
But things are not always as they seem. First of all, it's tough to be a contestant on one of those things.
Sure.
New York Magazine came out with an article recently where
and the best person might not win. Okay, well, that's one of the things that you got to realize when you're watching one of those shows is the best person has a bad day. The judge doesn't like it as well, they may not win.
Well, but the article in New York Magazine talked about the life that you lead if you become a Bravo reality TV contestant, and you're sequestered entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no hanky-panky between the contestants because they're afraid of being sued. And so it's rather grueling. It seems as though Top Chef does pretty good with coming across with the prize for the winner, though. And even guys who are runner-up in the food world, you know their names. I know their mm-hmm. names. I would, you know, I'd be more likely to hire somebody who came in third or fourth on Top
sure.
Chef because they have some name recognition. I'm sure it serves them well.
Well, the other thing about Top Chef, as compared to some of the other shows I've seen, is they also start with most of them. Start with credentials. Season one,
some
there were
experience.
A bunch of people who didn't have yeah. credentials,
but the other Bravo TV shows come under fire recently because that's a Runway.
Mm-hmm.
They have a pretty unusual arrangement there. The prize is $100,000 if you win on Runway, and their first winner, Jay McCarroll, has come out and he said, "Listen, he was presented with a choice. If he wanted the $100,000, he had to give up 10% of his brand to Weinstein, which are the agents
wow.
to represent him." So,
paying an agent.
Well,
I mean,
what you're doing is they build up this brand, and then they buy 10% of your brand, so that if you make $20 million, they make money on it. So he's really caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. And if you don't give him 10%, then you don't get the $100,000. So that's not really...
That doesn't
really
sound as much like a prize as a prize should be.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like, you know, I scratch a lottery ticket and I go and I hand it in and they give me money if I win.
But you've got to sell me 10% of you forever for $100,000. Now, granted, Joe on the street who hasn't won the show, that's probably a good deal for him. He may not be worth it, but he may.
Mm-hmm.
But they build up your brand, but then they take 10% of you forever. That $100,000 could be worth millions if you make it.
Right.
So I think that's pretty disingenuous.
The money I win on Wheel of Fortune, I win.
Yeah,
okay,
exactly.
I'm done. We're done.
But
thank you very much for your time.
Right. That's like saying if you win the money on Wheel of Fortune, that's great. Here's your $1,000, but we take 10% of your income for life.
If you're ever in a commercial, that's... You know.
Right, we take 10% of your income for life. And that's a little shady to me. But again, Top Chef, we like it. Calicchio, we love. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Bruce Neal. Bruce is a marine biologist whose special interest is in educating young people about nature. He and his wife, Evelyn Monroe Neal, have established the Sanibel Sea School, a nonprofit organization devoted to promoting ecological awareness through hands-on education.
Dr. Bruce Neal, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, now, as you pointed out, as we were speaking to you right before during the break, that you're not really a food guy, but you're a marine biologist and you're an ecology guy. And without the good ecology, well, there won't be any more food. That's a pretty
That's
good tie-in.
Absolutely true. Yes, absolutely. You know, and good ecologists deal with food. There's predators, there's prey.
Well, talk to us about the Sanibel Sea School. It sounds fascinating. When we read about it, we thought we have to get this guy on the air. Tell our audience what the Sanibel Sea School is and what you do.
You know, it's a nonprofit foundation to promote marine conservation. And so ultimately what we would like to do is we would like to sort of enhance the world's, the global's appreciation of the ocean. There are a lot of different ways you can do that, and what we have chosen to do is predominantly focus on young kids. And what we, our goal is to foster a love of the ocean in those kids.
And what you do is fun, right?
Absolutely.
Well,
yeah.
Talk about what you do. Now, where is the school located, and why there, and what do you do with our children when they get there?
You know, we're located on the east end of Sanibel Island, which is adjacent to Fort Myers, Florida, in southwest Florida. And we chose Sanibel Island for a number of reasons. I grew up in Miami. Evelyn had grown up in Alabama, spending time here as well. So we had some history with it. And Sanibel Island is an interesting municipality in that it is a very conservation-oriented community. And so most of the people who come here, most of the visitors come here for nature. So it's a great place to come. There's a large national wildlife refuge. It's kind of a slow little town. We kind of roll up our sidewalks at night. There are no street lights. There's not much nightlife. It's a very nature-oriented place. So from that perspective, it's a really great place to have a sea school like that. What we do with your kids is, you know, it varies. In the summertime, we have a more traditional sort of marine camp where kids come for 5 days a week and they do a whole variety of non-academic things as well as learn a little bit.
Well, now, let's just point out that the Sanibel Island is, it's 4 miles wide?
Miles wide at its widest and 12 miles long.
And so you've got a lot of ocean around you.
We do. We have tons of ocean around us.
You know, I think one of the things that we find in the world is that people who have experienced places like this, if you really are in love with Sanibel Island or the Florida Keys or one of those beautiful, beautiful places where you're intimately acquainted with the ocean, that people have a greater appreciation for what it gives you and the relationship that we have with it.
You know, I think it does, and that's part of what we'd like to build in people. And we would like people to take it back to Chicago or New Jersey or wherever they happen to be. If they happen to be, you know, in these kids in particular when they grow up, if they're an investment banker in Manhattan or, you know, a commodities trader in Chicago, what we want them to have is an appreciation for the ocean.
Hey, now we have great
beaches. I know that place.
We have great beaches in New Jersey. Take it easy.
Yeah, you do. No, you absolutely do. And we'll compare them in December.
Now, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, you said, no, the kids come down to you, they go for a 5-day sea school, they do some academic stuff, but they also do, like, they get their feet wet, right?
Well, all of our academic stuff is in the water. We don't do it. We spend very little time indoors. And so if we're teaching about mangroves, we do it in a mangrove swamp. When we're teaching about seagrass beds, they're in seagrass beds. So we literally are a field school. The difference between what we do in the summertime and the sort of wintertime or the springtime, if visitors come, is in the summertime, we at lunchtime, we go out and we paddle surfboards. We've just come back in the field 5 minutes ago from playing a giant predator-prey game out in the field.
What's a predator-prey game? Sounds like the world of business.
Yeah, well, exactly. There you go. This week we're studying alligators, who are a great top predator down here. And it's alligator
week. So you feed a couple of kids to the alligators and let the other kids watch? Is that what it is?
Exactly. It's the name of who is the slowest person on the team. Doesn't matter if you're next to last, only if you're last. It's a game where a couple of kids are the predators and a group of them are the prey. And it's not unlike a tag game, but they come to appreciate the fact that most predator-prey relationships aren't totally straightforward. And they, you know, they have to think about this. That if you're a predator, you just don't walk up to somebody and grab them. And if you're a prey, you don't walk up to a predator. And so there are a couple of rules where the prey also have to venture out into danger zones to grab their food.
Huh.
And so it's
may ultimately become the prey.
Exactly. Yep. So it's a giant game of tag, but there are these rules that expose you to predation.
And it's on surfboards, which is a heck of a lot of fun.
Well, this one wasn't on surfboards. The surfboards comes up next. That's after lunch, the surfboards.
Now, we have to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Bruce Neal talking about the Sanibel Sea School. And maybe it's a place where you can send your kids or go visit yourself. Back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. It's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The maragatta and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. We're talking with Bruce Neal, a marine biologist, about the Sanibel Sea School. Bruce, now, this is a school where kids can come and learn about the ocean and learn about a marine environment. Is it a ton of fun?
Oh, it's a ton of fun.
Who
Absolutely.
Comes? Who so sends their kids?
What's that?
Who sends their kids? Who comes?
Boy, you know, they come from all over. We right now have a couple of kids from Vienna. We've had kids from Paris. We've had kids from New York, Chicago, Canada, and we have kids locally. So any kids. And we bring adult kids, too. There are special days where we have adults, and they come out, and they pretend they're kids again.
So does a kid come out at 8 o'clock in the morning, let's say, and just spend the whole day with you? What's the?
They come at 9, and then they go home tired and happy and a little better educated at 4.
So are there places on Sanibel Island where the parents can have margaritas all afternoon while their kids learn stuff?
Absolutely. Yes, which is probably not an uncommon parental activity.
Now Sanibel Island is a small island. I understand that it's 60% nature preserve?
It is.
And the surrounding town, you say you have no streetlights, and the town that is not nature preserve is very concerned about remaining sort of raw bit of nature.
Right. So it is. It's a very progressive town. It was incorporated in the 1970s for conservation, with conservation motivations in mind. And so we do a lot of things for nature. The reason that we don't have streetlights is to not disturb nesting sea turtles. And they're young when they hatch at night. We have limits on the number of height, the number of stories of buildings. We have limits on all.
See, I thought it was just to keep the teenagers off the street.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? That just actually makes them more comfortable, you know, because it's not so hard to find a dark space to do something out of harm's way.
Well, and there are lots of luxury accommodations down there as well if for parents if they want to come and spend a few days down there.
Absolutely. It is a visitor destination.
Hey, listen, if you want to find out more about the Sanibel Sea School, you can go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Dr. Bruce Neal, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us on the radio show and for the good work that you do.
I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about food.
Well, we're actually going to go have a little snack while the news goes
we're
on.
Actually, anymore. Maybe we're going to have some sea turtle.
Oh, no.
There you go. Very good.
Anyway, we'll be back after the news. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left at Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
We're now talking with Jordan Silbert. Jordan Silbert has invented Q Tonic. It's a tonic water that's just hit the market this summer, and it's the best darn tonic water we've ever seen. Jordan, welcome to the show. How you doing, man?
I am doing fantastically.
Okay, now let me frame this issue here. People may not realize why we're having someone on to talk about. We have people on to talk about beverages all the time, alcoholic beverages all the time. One of the things that has always stuck in my craw since I first started to learn about real cocktails, oh, I guess in 1992 or so, is the gin and tonic is classic, and tonic is an ingredient in many things. But as we've gone over to making our own ingredients, to making our own bitters, to making our own grenadine, to making our own falernum, and to making our own sodas even, because we want to avoid the one of the things we want to avoid is high fructose corn syrup, which I feel anything you introduce into a drink that's sweetened with high fructose corn syrup just kills all the other subtlety you've done. Tonic has been the one thing that we have not been able to find that is great. Schweppes is a fine tonic. Canada Dry is a fine tonic as far as a soda is concerned, but they're made with high fructose corn syrup. They have as much sweetener as a Sprite, but real tonic takes quinine, and we had been unable to find a great quinine. Q Tonic solved that problem for us. Are you as nutsy as we are? What's the problem, Jordan?
I think I'm probably more nutsy than you are. It took me about 4 years to come up with this thing, and literally started by boiling quinine bark in my kitchen for about a year or so until someone accused me of running an urban meth lab in the kitchen. I'm probably as nuts, if not more nuts than you are. I was kind of sick of commercial tonics, and especially all the awful high fructose corn syrup in it. And thought I could make something better, and it took about 4 years, and I think I finally have, and it's just on the market. It seems to be selling fantastically, so I'm pretty happy with the whole thing.
Well, Jordan, you're saying you spent 4 years working on this. I'm going to tell you seriously that Francis and I, for over a year and a half, have been trying to make our own tonic water, our own quinine, because we were very unhappy with the tonic in the marketplace, and just haven't been able to get it the way we want it.
We failed miserably.
we didn't come close, I admit it. But
so there's two secrets. The first is finding good quinine. The other is the carbonation. And it's really hard to self-carbonate something up to the level that I think is needed to make it as sharp and as crisp as what I wanted, and I assume you wanted. And so you really do have to use a commercial bottler to bottle the things out if you really want to get up to the 4.2-4.3 gas volumes like we have.
Let's talk about what makes quinine different from any other kind of soda, because I can make orange soda. I can make grape soda, and better than any that's out there. I have currently behind the bar some rosemary soda that's amazing, but the quinine... But tonic water uses quinine. I remember my grandmother used to call it quinine water.
Yep.
What is quinine?
I call my thing Q Tonic, actually.
Oh.
Q Tonic is actually after quinine.
So what is quinine?
Quinine is an alkaloid, which is a kind of a salt, found in a bark that's native to the Peruvian Andes of the Quinchona tree, which used to be called the Quinquina tree until the Spanish renamed it after a countess who got really sick from malaria, and this is back in the 1630s or something, and got asked the Incas the Spanish tried all of their recipes, to all their miracle cures, and nothing really worked. So they finally, at the end of the day, went to the Incas and said, guys, my wife is dying. It was the wife of the governor of Peru. And said, Incas, my wife is dying. What can you do to save her? And they took the magical tree, and they mixed it up and heated it up and put all this, other spices and herbs in. And she took it and, took it for a number of days and finally was cured and was known as a miracle cure. And so what the Spanish did was, first of all, thanking the Incas so much, they renamed the tree after this woman. Then they obviously killed them and stole all their gold. And then soon started exporting it to Europe, where it was used as a miracle cure for a lot of things, but in particular to cure malaria.
I mean, quinine has saved a lot of lives. I'm not sure that everybody realizes.
Millions and millions of lives, and that's actually how the gin and tonic was started. that it was actually prescribed as a medicine for British and other colonial troops throughout throughout the South Pacific and even Africa, where there was a lot of malaria, and the troops had to was given this medicine. It was really bitter. It was like medicine. It was really bitter and awful tasting, and they had to take it at dawn as a slug. And some really, back in the 1820s, some really ingenious, or hard drinking, depending on how you look at the whole thing, officers in the British Army decided that instead of waking up at dawn and drinking this really bitter medicine with the troops, it'd be a lot better if you mixed it with gin, sugar, and water and made it a cocktail and drank it on a veranda at the end of the day after working all day.
Jordan,
and
these are a few of my favorite things.
Yes, verandas, cocktails.
And then what happened was, so that was the thing, and it was, you know, it was what you drank out in the colonies, so it was good, and it was, you know, good, like it was camping good, like that you were really living away from your home country. And so what happened was, when these officers came back to England, and they would go to their, you know, their gentlemen's clubs and have a, you know, they would say, "Sir, what would you like to drink?" And the guy would say, you know, in a loud voice so that all his friends and like club members could hear, said, "Actually, I'd like a gin and tonic." And by so doing that, by doing, you know, saying that you wanted a gin and tonic really loudly, everybody could see that you had been in the King's Army and that you were, you know, a tough guy, and it became the cool thing to do. And that's kind of how the gin and tonic became the quintessential drink of the British Empire.
You don't really have to be a tough guy to drink a gin and tonic anymore.
These days, not at all, especially when you put organic agave in it.
I'll knock that pith helmet right off your head. Hey, but what happened now? When we started looking into how to replace in our unsuccessful bid to try and make our own tonic water, we found that there is no quinine in most commercial tonic waters now. What happened to it?
It's synthetic quinine. What happened was, long story short, or this question is how long I have to talk, because I could talk literally for hours about the whole thing. Peru, it was all from quinine from the slopes of the Peruvian Andes, and it's native there. Peru kind of prevented the export at the beginning. And that drove the price really high. And the price of natural quinine was, at one point, worth literally its weight in gold. So you would put, you know, in the markets of Europe, you would have a scale, and on one side you put a little quinine bark, on the other side you would put gold, and they would balance out, and then they would literally trade. And that was the price. So it was so expensive and so sought after that a bunch of people tried to smuggle it out. Finally, this guy, Charles Ledgeler, in the 1850s, actually did smuggle it out. Tried to offered it to the British government first. The British had been tricked by another guy who had said he had smuggled something out, but it was actually a different plant, maybe 2 or 3 years earlier. They said no. The Dutch jumped at the chance. They bought it from this guy, Ledgeler, and then they planted it throughout their colonies, both the Congo but also Indonesia. And before World War II, about 95% of the world's quinine came from Indonesia, as kind of Peru over-harvested their quinine.
Now, does the Schweppes in Canada Dry on the market, do they contain quinine?
Yes, but it's a synthetic quinine. So in World War II, Japan took over Indonesia. It was running out of oil, and they took over Indonesia, you know, Royal Dutch Shell. There's a ton of oil in Indonesia, and the Japanese war machine needed all that oil. So they took over Indonesia, and the Allies at the beginning were like, "Oh, geez, we lost all that oil." Then they realized pretty quickly that they also lost their supply of quinine, which was the anti-malarial agent that they were still giving their troops. And so they're still fighting, I believe, in North Africa and the South Pacific. So they did a little mini Manhattan Project and had their scientists back home come up with another way to prevent malaria. And they kind of scientifically recreated the molecule, if I understand.
But does the synthetic quinine have the same flavor as the natural quinine?
Insofar as, you know, artificial sugar has the same flavor as regular sugar. it recreates the bitterness, and it recreates more specifically the anti-malarial properties, but it doesn't have the depth of flavor that real quinine does.
Okay, now, when I went out to try and create the quinine, I saw that Per Se in New York created a quinine, and I saw that the gentleman who's been on our show actually created a gin and tonic there.
Paul Roberts.
Ryan?
He used... It wasn't crystallized quinine. It was a brown powder that we were able to get that was sold as quinine. But gin and tonic generally isn't brown. What kind of quinine do you use?
That's the ground bark.
Uh-huh.
So the bark is reddish brown.
Uh-huh.
And the question is how much of that – and the bark, it has – if something like 30 different alkaloids in it. So it's had to extract the quinine, which is actually, it's a little yellow tincture, but it's not as brown as the actual bark. So my understanding of what Perse was doing was that they were using the bark, the control bark,
yes.
And using that. And that actually has the other 30 alkaloids as well as the actual bark. And so the color comes in part from the quinine, but more from the other stuff as well.
When we come back, we're going to talk about how quinine is actually a controlled substance, which was something else I found out about.
Yes.
And we're talking with Jordan Silbert, the inventor of Q-Tonic, the world's first tonic in a long time that will change your view of a gin and tonic. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:46.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 US patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest is Jordan Silbert. He's the inventor of Q-Tonic. Q-Tonic is a high-end tonic on the market that has actually natural quinine in it. We were talking before the break about Mark and my failed attempts to make a great tonic water with actual quinine and without high fructose corn syrup. And we found out, Jordan, and when we tried to do that, that crystallized quinine is a controlled substance. What's the deal with that?
My understanding is that it's a digestif. It's a bitter, like other bitters, like Campari, like Bekarovka from Czechoslovakia. And what bitters do is they're supposed to settle your stomach and aid digestion. And part of what that does is speed up your circulation system. And for, the Incas and the other people who have been using quinine for a long time actually use quinine not just to cure anti-malaria, not just to cure malaria, but also to cure other ailments, including, kind of stomach issues and other things. And so my understanding is that quinine kind of speeds up your system a little. And for people who have kind of heart conditions, if you have too much of it, it causes a little too much pressure on the on your heart, and that's why apparently it's regulated, is my understanding of the thing.
Now, the thing about the Q-Tonic, and I will tell you, there are a couple of other good tonics that have hit the market sort of simultaneously with yours, and I tried them all, and I found that, they were all kind of good, but yours really, I think, is the best tonic on the market. And what was most interesting about your tonic is it has a bright, very bright carbonation, like you said.
Yeah.
You sell it. It's not inexpensive, I'll say that. And it comes in 6-ounce bottles. The idea, of course, being that there's one portion per bottle, so you always have cracked a fresh bottle. You didn't pop the 2-liter thing and let it go flat in your refrigerator for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And tonic is bitter. It is bitter, as you say. But when your Q-Tonic is mixed with an aromatic gin, it seems sweeter.
It was one of the first things we did with all the tonics that we tasted was to taste them with different types of gin, obviously.
And also straight, and also just with no gin at all.
Yep.
Frankly, I don't find tonic to be pleasant without gin in it. but some of the tonics that were, these were, and the thing about the Schweppes and the Canada Dry is they're just sweet. They're sweet stuff with a little bit of bitterness. All the really good tonics are actually bitter. What your tonic did that the other high-end ones that have come out is it was bitter to drink by itself, but when mixed with gin, which is not sweet, the whole drink seems sweeter. How does that work?
What it did is we made a decision to use organic agave to sweeten it for...
Instead of cane sugar, which would be more
traditional. Instead of cane sugar. And we did that for one reason, and one reason only, is that it tastes better. And what it does is agave rather than cane sugar has a longer sweetness and a longer rounder sweetness. So in that gin tonic that you're tasting, really especially the aromatic ones that have multiple kind of at least minor notes going through the taste, that the gin and tonic made with a Q-tonic really becomes a three-note cocktail. And so a lot of what you're taking, you know, with that quinine, with the juniper, or the juniper probably first, then the quinine, and then the agave. And that is what you're actually tasting when you're tasting the sweetness. So it's not more sweet, it's actually a longer sweetness, and you actually, as a sensation, the entire kind of taste, the entire sip tastes more sweet. But I would also say it has some other notes as well. But it's that length rather than the kind of the actual amount that you're probably tasting.
And that length of sweetness, what Jordan's talking about there, he's not talking about that cloying sweetness that sticks with you after you have something with corn syrup in it. He's talking about a length of finish, right, like you would talk about
the
in,
gin
a great,
continues
in a great
to
wine.
Finish. Yeah, the gin continues to finish along with it as well.
Yes, and the gin, and the idea is this, like a Schweppes tonic water, like you really can't taste the difference between, you know, a Plymouth gin and tonic with a Schweppes or a, you know, a Bombay Sapphire or a Bombay Regal, you can't really tell that much because the sugar just dominates it. And the idea with Q-tonic is with the agave that it really complements these good gins and that you can actually tell all the tastes and all the notes in those gins. So yeah, the sugar, the sweetness rounds out, but also the gin and all of the botanicals and all that they've decided to include play out also over the length of the taste.
You know, it's great. It's interesting that you say that. We have brought in a gin that right now we're the only one in the countries that have. It's actually distilled by a friend of ours, a guy named Hans Reisebauer in Austria, and it's a Reisebauer's Blue Gin. It's called because
Linnell Smothers, one of my dear friends. Just called that the best gin going.
Who's Linnell Smothers? We think it's the best gin going. We brought it into the country. Who's Linnell Smothers?
She runs a great Brooklyn.
Oh yeah, she probably tasted it through the our distributor who we brought it in through. But they brought it in as a favor to us, and I said, or Mark and I both said, you know, sell it because I want to see Hans move this stuff. I was in Austria in the summer. I had it everywhere. It's the best gin going.
It is almost like a juniper eau de vie. The thing about it is
it's, we tried to make it into cocktails, and I've made a couple of cocktails with it, but we need to be very careful because it's a very subtle, subtle gin.
Yep.
But with your tonic, you can taste the subtlety and the beauty of this gin.
That's the absolute idea, is that the better the gin is, the more that our Q-tonic, you know, lets it be better, and more the better the cocktail is.
Hey Jordan, we have to go soon, but right now your tonic is only available to the public through select bars and restaurants, and it's at Whole Foods, right?
It's at Whole Foods down at their flagship store down in Austin, Texas, in Lamar One.
What's it retail for?
For the suggested price is $4 for $9.99.
$4 for $9.99. That's an expensive tonic, dude.
But very expensive tonic. Unfortunately, it cost me a fortune to make.
I'm sure.
Totally worth it.
Hey, listen, we've got to go. We have a commercial coming up. We'll be back in just a moment. Jordan, thanks for taking the time to talk with us about Q-tonic.
It's been fantastic talking to you guys.
Thanks, Jordan.
Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. A gin and tonic is a drink that I have always sort of like it, but I never really thought much of it.
Mm-hmm.
Gin and tonic with the Q-tonic. Look, how often have you heard me recommend a drink where you put gin in it and then a bottled soda?
It's like a cocktail. When you use an ingredient like this, you're showing the different flavor profiles of the two things, and one equals three. And that's the whole idea of a great cocktail is to make or great food or matching wine and food. You always want to make 1 and 1 equal 3.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, I mean, look, what did he say it was for 4 bottles of tonic water? We're talking 6 ounce bottles of tonic water. It retails for $10.
Right.
Okay. Gin and tonic's going to be $3 more.
Right.
In our restaurant, if you use the Q-tonic, but it's completely worth it. It really is. You know, it's produced on a small scale by this guy. I think it has every layer of complexity that I would want in a cocktail.
It's delicious. It's not something that I don't drink tonic straight just because I don't really love tonic, but in a gin and tonic, it's great. This is what they were thinking of when they invented a gin and tonic.
What they made until 1910, and then they stopped. Well, we've been using Q-tonic for a couple of weeks now, and it's amazing. I mean, I have a gin and tonic, much more often than I should. So we have not. This is not a commercial advertisement. We have not been paid for this. I love the idea. I've been searching for a tonic for a long time.
Like
really
always,
glad I found one.
We just talk about stuff we love.
Dorks is what we are. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. It's time for a gin and tonic.